Honors. Paul Smith for the RIAA. May it please the Court. The RIAA has challenged two aspects of the decision of the Copyright Royalty Board in this proceeding involving the mechanical compulsory license. They are, first, the imposition for the first time in 100 years that this license has existed of a 1.5% per month late fee. And then, second, the decision to set a fixed 24-cent royalty rate for ringtones. Let me start with the late fee issue, if I might, and say the basic problem with the decision of the CRJs on this issue is that they did not base their decision on the late fee on any evidence of record. It was not that there was any shortage of evidence they could have relied on. The parties put in a considerable amount of evidence. The evidence showed, for example, that in the voluntary marketplace, it was almost never the case that the parties negotiated a late fee for licenses of rights like the ones at issue in this case. There was also considerable evidence.
Late fee for royalties and webcasting and satellite digital radio?
There were late fees imposed by the CRJs in those cases, Your Honor, but those cases were distinguishable in very important ways, three different ways, in fact. First of all, there were marketplace agreements. There were benchmarks in those cases that the judges were able to cite and rely on. Here, the marketplace evidence went the opposite way. The other thing about those licenses is they didn't have a termination right, so that the party licensing the rights could not take it back if the licensee didn't pay. Here you had a termination right after a 30-day cure period, so there's a very different situation. And the judges in the prior cases relied very specifically on that in deciding there had to be a draconian late fee that would prevent people from paying late. And the third issue that was different in those cases is that in those cases there was no argument that the late payments were the fault of the payee, the people being paid. Here, there was considerable evidence in the record that the reason most of the late payments occurred was that the songwriters and publishers failed to figure out who was owed how much on each song. Essentially, they would go into the studio, they would write a song and record the song. It would be rushed out to the marketplace by the record company, and this was custom and practice. But it would take months often to decide who had what percentage share as a songwriter in that song. And in the meantime, the record company essentially couldn't pay anybody.
What do you do with the you got way ahead of me. I was looking for this reference in the joint appendix that I read in preparation. What do you do with the so there was no evidence of any market agreements. What about JA 523 unredacted?
JA 523, Your Honor. This testimony from the record.
Right.
Well, you're talking about paragraph 848, Your Honor?
Right.
That has a reference to agreements between record companies and digital music services involving very different things. That's where the record company has created a record and the digital music service is going to sell it, like Apple is going to sell it for iPods. Those contracts have late fees in them, but the contracts between the music publishers and composers and the record companies for mechanical rights, the right to record a composition, do not contain late fees in the marketplace. So there's marketplace evidence of late fees in other contexts, but that's a completely different context.
But your clients are parties to.
Yes, Your Honor. The market is the market, and there's reasons why you don't have a late fee in the one context, because you have this split problem that I was explaining where you can't figure out who to pay. When the record company licenses a song to Apple, there's only one person who needs to get paid. It's the record company who made the record. So you don't have the same problems. The other thing that has evolved in this marketplace for the rights to compositions to be recorded is advances. There's millions of dollars that are paid by the record companies to the publishers to cover the fact that they can't pay on time. So the money is actually in the pockets of the publishers, and they're the ones earning the interest on it in many cases. But they want to add a late fee on top of that. So you have a market that's been around for 100 years. There's never been a late fee in this market. There are things that have been done to deal with the problems of late payments where they're necessitated by the fact that nobody knows who to pay. They have advances, and then they want to point to evidence about a very different.
Give me a typical. You mentioned Apple. Give me run through, because I really didn't get this from the briefs of either side, and maybe I missed it, but. I'm really not sure I understand the way these transactions work. Why don't you run through a typical transaction with Apple by one of the companies that you represent?
Well, we represent the record companies. And,
right.
And the transaction issue in this case is a transaction between the record company and the music publisher that owns the rights to a composition. You have a right under the statute if the song has been recorded once.
Well, who transacts with Apple?
Well, that's a second stage transaction once the song has been recorded. Apple sells recordings. But we're talking in this case about the right to make the recording, to record the song. And that is the compulsory license. If a song has been recorded once, everybody in the world can record it, can make what's called a cover recording of that song. So Paul McCartney sings Yesterday. Anybody can make a recording of Yesterday.
Well, he actually means Apple Corps, not the Apple Company, right?
Yeah.
Because that's the name of the Beatles
right.
Company.
I'm, yeah. Maybe that's right. It's a record company, after
yes.
all. So the way this transaction works is that you make the recording and you go to the place that issues licenses for that recording, which is usually but not always something called the Harry Fox Agency, and say, I have recorded this song, and I want you to issue a license to me. They don't have a choice. They just do it, and there's a set rate for it, and there's set terms for it. And then you pay whoever the Harry Fox Agency tells you to pay. It often might be four different publishing companies, and they have different percentage splits that they eventually will tell you what they are. So you issue checks every quarter to this publishing company and this publishing company and this for their share of the royalties that are earned of the royalties that are earned on the sales of that recording. And the royalty is based on how many records are sold with that song in it. So there's 9.1 for physical products is 9.1 cents per song sold. And it has to be then divided up among many music publishers so that they typically get less than 9.1 cents for any particular request.
When when the record talks about some billions of dollars of late payments, mm-hmm. how do they calculate what's late? Is it payments that Fox says haven't come in on time, or where does that number come from? I appreciate you dispute the number, where's the nature of the number come
that
from?
That was somewhat obscure, but I think what that is that particular study, which is, by the way, very deceptive in the way it was constructed, was payments after they're due once they've figured out what the splits are, then a formal license issues, and then there's the money's due 45 days after the end of every calendar quarter, you have to pay these royalties. And what that study shows is that there's a substantial number of cases where payments come in a day late, 2 days late, 3 days late.
That's after the split's been decided.
Yes, yes. That's what that study's about, as I understand it, Your Honor.
And this late fee is even before a split's decided.
Well, the way how
is it calculated?
The late fee that was set by the judges.
Yes, that's.
Would be triggered ostensibly the way the regulation reads the day you make the recording. So all of that time period when you're trying to figure out the splits, at least arguably, if you borrow that term and apply it to the system as it really exists out there, you would have the 1.5% adding on for all that time period, because the way the judges did it, it wasn't triggered to when the formal license was issued. It was triggered to when the recording was first sold.
And the money couldn't be paid to Fox or to some company that would hold it until the splits are decided.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
And the money couldn't be paid to Fox or to some company that is holding the money until the splits are decided. Fox is the principal.
In fact, in many instances, money is paid in the form of these advances, which are not, as I understand it.
What I'm asking is, would that eliminate the? It wouldn't be late if you get it in on time to them.
It's not at all clear that that would work that way. The advances are chunks of money which are sitting there. How that would interact with this new late fee that has been imposed on the marketplace by the judges is somewhat uncertain at this point.
What incentive without a late fee do you have to make timely payment?
I don't know that there's any specific incentive. We obviously have a legal obligation to do it, and they didn't establish it.
I have a legal obligation to pay my credit card bill monthly. But unless they imposed a late fee, I'd rather take the float. And one of the factors that the judges pointed to was setting a fee sufficiently high to give you an incentive to pay on time and not so high as to constitute a penalty.
Well, 18% interest, Your Honor, is pretty high, particularly if
you've entered into contracts with the same interest rate. That's JA 532.
contracts in which it is possible for the payer to pay on time. Here we have this problem, which is that the person who is getting the 18% interest has it within his power to prevent you from making the payment by not telling you who to pay it to. You could end up with this perverse outcome where people are going to end up actually not giving you the splits because they'd rather earn the 18% interest. This is a very specific marketplace which has very specific conditions in it, and the judges just simply disregarded those, even though the evidence was all in the record. I mean, the one thing that's clear under the statutory standard is they have to be basing their decisions on substantial evidence. And they can't just say, well, we did this last time and you haven't given us a good reason to change it. Just last year in the intercollegiate broadcasting case.
Why can't they say that?
Well, that's exactly what this court in the intercollegiate broadcasting case said you can't do.
Well, I mean, on this question, the statute authorizes late fees. And the only question, if there had been no late fee, I assume someone would have been complaining about that. But it seems like there's a zone of reasonableness within which the copyright royalty judges can operate. And given that the statute authorizes the late fee, I'm having trouble seeing what our role is in second-guessing the selection of a particular late fee or even no late fee at all, unless it becomes so unreasonable. And why is it so unreasonable?
The statute does not direct them to establish
authorizes.
Authorizes them to do that. Now,
that's my point. They could go at zero, sure. I think that's fair. Or they can set one.
Right.
And the choice seems to be theirs, and the question is whether it's reasonable, right?
No, the question is whether or not there's substantial evidence to support it. And they specifically eschewed even making findings about the evidence that was presented, said we're not going to resolve the conflicts in the evidence, and we're not going to look at the marketplace agreements. We don't care what they say. We're just going to go at 1.5%.
When there are conflicts in the evidence, those are going to exist no matter what they.
Right, but they don't resolve them. That's what they're judges. You have a trial. They make findings of fact. Then they take the findings of fact, and they can make decisions. But when you have a substantial evidence
standard, ultimately a policy judgment, not a fact finding.
Well, it is.
And there's a lot of the factors in the statute that they're looking at here reflect a lot of conflicting policies that they're supposed to look at. And this statute gives huge discretion, as we've been through before, to these judges.
We're not going to get that issue, are we, Your Honor?
It's the elephant, but I assume it's not here today.
Not today.
This is typical rate making. I don't know. How can you make a judgment that 1.5 is better than 1.4 and not as good as 1.6?
I wasn't clear. Are you making an argument about the amount, either with respect to this or the ringtones?
No, our argument with respect to the late fee is that there shouldn't be one because the marketplace evidence shows that that in this market there isn't any role for one.
You're not making an argument that 1.5 is too high or something like that.
It's the same with the ringtones. It is the fact that it's a fixed rate that is the problem because there again, the marketplace evidence.
You are arguing it's too high. It should be zero.
Well, fine, if you want to put it that way, Your Honor, there shouldn't be one because that's, what's interesting under these 801B factors, in every other situation going back many years, they start with the marketplace benchmarks and then they look and see whether the factors require some adjustment. And they did that in this case on all the other issues they decided. But somehow on the late fee, the fact that the marketplace benchmarks say there isn't one in this market for a lot of specific reasons, which were elaborated at some great length to them, became irrelevant. And they said, well, we're just going to apply the 801B factors independent of what the marketplace is, which is completely contrary to what they do every other time when they apply these factors. And they ended up even with this very strange elocution, which was, RIAA hasn't given them any reason for a downward adjustment of the 1.5%, as if it somehow already exists. You have to have some evidentiary basis for establishing it in the first place.
As Judge Randolph said, common sense would tell you that a late fee makes sense in certain circumstances. You responded to that with an argument, true in some circumstances, but not here because it's impossible for us to know when to pay, who to pay. And can you just spell that out? Because I want to hear more about that.
Because the way the system works in the real world, and this has been goes back 100 years, the record company doesn't make payments until it's established who owns what rights to that song. Mm-hmm. And so the problem of working out splits is a major factor in delaying these payments. And that's the reason, one of the reasons why the marketplace doesn't have a late fee in it. On the question of whether there's a
and there's
common
no
sense,
way there's going to be no way under what the copyright royalty judges did to accommodate that concern.
Well, there could be, Your Honor, but it changes completely the bargaining position of the parties, and that's what this whole case is really about, is where you, the starting point from all those conversations, and that's why we've all basically fought it out for a long time on this issue. And on the issue of whether common sense is enough, if you, I would cite you to RIAA versus the Librarian, 1999, the case which flatly says a plausible explanation is not enough. You need evidence to support it and reverse the
Well, they looked at what they thought were analogous industries and borrowed the 1.5% late fee from there, right?
Without looking at the marketplace evidence about this industry, which contradicts them, and without taking into account the differences between those situations and this involving the termination,
they did,
right?
They did mention that. I mean, obviously you have an argument against it. That I was just looking at it, and they acknowledged your argument that there would be difficulty in trying to figure out the to timely make the correct payment, and they said, well, that's not our problem.
Well, they did acknowledge it, and they did say it's not our problem, but you can't make anything out of the reason why they say it's not our problem. I read that sentence on JA 681 over and over again, and it just doesn't make any sense to me, Your Honor. It doesn't scan. It says, the reasons why payments are late, however, represent the party's disagreement with the payment requirements set forth in the statute. It doesn't justify anything or explain why you are going to ignore the fact that in this particular odd marketplace, late payments are often the fault of the payee and not the payor.
On the penny rate issue, can I ask you a question about that?
Sure, Your Honor.
Why isn't that reasonable for the simple reason that it's easily calculated? Well, why isn't that enough? Given our standard of review, why isn't it enough to say, They decided for reasons of convenience to choose this. That's, given our deference, that's good enough.
Well, what the evidence showed was that this was a new product, that the parties, when they sat down 6 or 7 years ago to figure out how to pay for this new product when there was no statutory rate, agreed that it should be paid on a percentage basis because nobody knew where the rate, the price was going to go, and therefore how much royalty should be paid on it. And it shows that it went way up in price, and now it's the demand is falling substantially. And so when you fix a penny rate at the top of the market, it creates a real market problem. In addition, precisely because that
wasn't quite at the very top of the market, right?
24 cents is 10% of $2.40. So
there were higher proposals, right?
If you call the market as including the proposals that the parties made in the court, that's certainly the case. Okay. I didn't suggest that they actually picked the highest proposal and adopted it, but it certainly was, as a 10% of the retail price, it was the top of the market. I think $2.50 was about as high as
Can
anybody
ever paid
for a ringtone.
Can you explain to me how that the ringtone transactions work?
Sure, Your Honor.
He doesn't have any kids at home whose cell phones go off every 5 minutes.
Ringtones come into play after there's a record, or about the same time as sometimes simultaneous. Somebody records a hit song. Then what the record company does is it licenses somebody just as a ringtone seller to sell a ringtone, which is an excerpt of the song.
Verizon, right?
Right, often it's Verizon.
Okay. You license Verizon.
Right. And then when the ringtone is sold, somebody has to pay a royalty back to the composer of the song, the publisher and the composer of the song. It's a mechanical royalty. Right. It's either paid by the record company or it's paid by the digital seller, but somebody's got to pay it. And so the question is, what is the rate for that particular piece of a song? And it so happens that the rate is actually quite a bit higher for that than it is for the whole
song. So you're selling typically for $1.99 a song? Is that what the deal is? And then
on a ringtone, it was the evidence at the time of trial showed it was $2, $2.50.
And then you get that payment from stay with Verizon, mm-hmm. and then you submit back a percentage or a set sum of that back to the copyright owner?
Under the deals that were struck. It would be sold for $2.50. The record company would get half, dollar and a quarter, and they would pay 10%, right. Which is $2.24 to the.
So your ox is gored if and only if the license fees that you're negotiating begin to go down.
The retail price goes down.
Right.
Wholesale price. Really.
If they go up, then you're in great shape.
But the evidence, exactly, and the reason why the parties negotiated a percentage is they didn't know what it was going to do, and it was a very unstable new product. It was a fad product, And the marketplace uniformly said, we're going to pay this on the basis of a percentage. And the judges took that percentage and converted it over to a fixed penny just because they have a preference for fixed pennies. It's not like it has any, there's no any real reason in the world why.
When's the next go-round on this?
I think it starts in about a year, Your Honor.
About a year. So I mean, and you're just finishing, then you're now at 240, so you're actually in pretty good shape.
No, we aren't now. At the time of trial, it was 240.
But what are you now?
What the evidence at trial showed is the demand was plummeting. Yeah. And that price would soon follow. And the problem is that piracy is active in the ringtone market as it is anywhere else, and people are starting to sell ringtones for a buck.
Can I ask about this part of it? I understand the statement that says nobody actually does compulsory licenses, but somehow it affects the market anyway. I'm accepting that on faith because both sides seem to say that. But if it should come to this horror, that the compulsory license is higher than the amount that you can make any money at all, wouldn't, since you can't make any money at all, you're not going to be selling ringtones at all, wouldn't a negotiated price then result?
It could. You'd have to go back to the publishers of all the different companies that have a split in that song and try to get them to all agree to a discount.
But the alternative is they get zero, right? Because you wouldn't be selling ringtones.
It would be, but it's obviously extremely difficult. And for a ringtone product, it's probably not something that's worth a lot of time and effort to negotiate because it's going to end up being more transaction costs than you can make in the sale of that product. The evidence showed that for discount budget records, they often do that kind of thing. But in the ringtone marketplace, there's just not enough money there probably.
I just have one more question.
Sure.
I can't find it. I'm not even going to look for it. But do I recall that one of these, that we've got on the one hand the penny fee, and then the description is a usage-based fee. What is that? How is this a usage-based fee?
As I understand the judges, they think that a penny rate is a usage-based fee because you pay the 9 cents for every song that gets sold.
But not every time it rings, right?
Well, no. On the ring, on the ringtone, it would be it's every. No, it's not that. It's every time you sell.
My house, you'd be making.
It's downloaded onto somebody's phone. No, it is a payment on each sale. They call it a usage fee. That is a term that they have evolved at the CRJs.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks very much, Mr. Smith. All right. Who are we hearing from next? From the government. Corcoran.
May it please the court, my name is Kelsey Brown Corcoran. I'm here on behalf of the government, and we've allotted 5 minutes of our time to my colleague Jay Cohen, who represents the copyright owners. I'd like to start with the late fee term and in particular address the two primary challenges that the record companies offer in this appeal and explain why both of those challenges lack merit. And I'll start with this confusion over ownership splits. The reason this is a non-issue is because everyone agrees that under the regulatory and statutory framework, the record companies have no obligation to resolve ownership splits. You can see intervener's brief, page 20, goes over the framework. Their royalties are not due until after a song owner has registered the song and I registered the copyright with the Copyright Office. And so the copyright is then under that copyright owner's name. And the regulations make clear that when you're talking about the Section 115 license, the record companies or the copyright user is free to simply pay one copyright owner and then put the onus on that owner to distribute the royalty correctly.
So the problem Mr. Smith was talking about, you say, is not a problem.
Well, what I'm saying is that in the context of Section 115, the notion that there are ownership splits, confusion that's resulting in delays is a complete fiction.
What's the reg? What's the cite to the reg that you're talking about?
It's on page 20 of the intervener's brief. They actually just sent you an errata with the actual cite. And I'll point you to, I don't think that the record companies would dispute this, but just out of caution, it's page 14, footnote 3 of their reply brief. They talk about this. There's no dispute about this.
Well, I thought Mr. Smith was disputing that they're going to get jammed
Yeah. So what's going on here? What they're talking about when they talk about these ownership splits is the voluntary agreements that they have with Harry Fox. And for unknown reasons that are, frankly, between the parties, they have not incorporated the terms of that regulation into their voluntary contracts. And so that's why in the voluntary contract context, you have these ownership disputes. So what the judges were saying in their decision is, you've talked a lot in the proceedings about this confusion over ownership splits, but you have not shown any causal relationship between that confusion and what actually goes on under the Section 115 license.
Because
under the Section 115 license, they have no obligation to resolve ownership disputes.
Because they can pay the one.
Yes, they can pay just the one. And for the most part, the Harry Fox contracts resemble the terms that are in the Section 115 license. This is one narrow area where, in fact, they don't, and has enormous significance in this particular context. I mean, the oddity about the Section 115 license, and the judges talk about this at the beginning of their decisions, no one actually uses it. It's just a ghost in the attic. So the parties care about this because it's going to affect their bargaining power in terms of the voluntary contracts. And so this is a closely related point, but the copyright owners reiterated over and over again in the proceedings below that the late term that they were proposing would not go into effect until after the ownership splits had been resolved. And I can give you sites for that as well. It's JA 526.27
Does the regulation, the final rule that was issued here, does it say what you just said, that the late fees don't go into effect?
Well, so this is another awkwardness having to, in the Section 115 license, the late fee couldn't go into effect until after ownership splits are resolved because there are no ownership splits to be resolved in that context. So this really is a non-issue in the Section 115 license. The question is, how are the parties going to incorporate the regulatory term into their voluntary contracts?
Is the regulation that you're talking about for compulsory licenses or
yes.
for all?
Sorry.
The regulation that you said.
It's for all of Section 115. It's in, I can give you the copyright owners, just let's see. So the new regulation is 37 CFR 385.4. It's in the supplemental, or I guess the addendum, page 2 of the intervener's brief. And they just sent you an errata.
So this says, I'm looking at it on as part of the judge's decision at the end. For any a licensee shall pay a late fee of 1.5% per month. This is on JA 682. For any payment received by the copyright owner after the due date set forth in 201.19E7I. And what is that due date?
I don't have that one in front of me, but I think the more significant...
Maybe the people sitting at your table could pass you a...
I think the more significant point, though, is that 37 CFR 201.18A6, thanks, is still in effect, right? So... 201.18A6 makes clear that they have no obligation to pay anyone but one copyright owner, who will then go on to pay the other copyright owners. So there are no ownership splits in the context of the Section 115
license.
If Mr.
Smith were right that there was difficulty in knowing whom to pay, then it would be arbitrary and capricious.
Well, then presumably the judges would have said something different than what they said in their decision, which is there is no causal relationship between these ownership splits and the late term that we are considering in the context of Section 115. And so I'll say again what I was starting to get at before is the copyright owners said over and over again in the proceedings below they weren't looking for a late fee that was going to be imposed during the time when the ownership splits are being resolved.
What they said why is that relevant?
It's important. I mean, again, we're talking about a ghost in the attic here. So they're obviously the term that they're proposing is only in the context of Section 115, where there are no ownership splits. But to the extent that they are talking about incorporating that term into their contracts later on, they were clear that they weren't attempting to kind of extract additional fees by exploiting this confusion. And I'll say also, I think it's important that the record companies witness, Andrea Finkelstein of Sony BMG, also testified that the late fees wouldn't accrue while splits are being resolved, and that's on JA 457. So I wouldn't assert that she necessarily speaks for all the record companies, but it certainly suggests that everyone thought this was really smoke and mirrors in terms of the implications or the intersection between the ownership splits and the late fees. So that's the first issue, and I hope I've explained why it's not actually an issue. The judges addressed it in both the rehearing decision and then also in their main decision. The second issue that Mr. Smith...
What about the argument that it wasn't based on anything in the marketplace?
Well, I can get to that. I was going to talk about termination rights, but I can talk about that first if you'd like. So you can't actually talk about the extent to which late fees occur under the Section 115 license because no one uses the Section 115 license. So the only context in which you can talk about it is these Harry Fox contracts where you've got all these ownership splits occurring. I will say, though, on footnote 50 of the judge's decision, they specifically credit the Pedersen testimony that we kind of flesh out in our brief, and that's a testimony by the Harry Fox CFO who basically explained the extent to which late payments are a problem in the context of the voluntary contracts. And if you look at that footnote, it says that there's conflicting testimony between the Pedersen, there's conflict between the Pedersen testimony, then goes on to cite some of the record company's testimony regarding the extent to which the ownership splits are the fault of the copyright owners. But it's important when you read that footnote to understand that the citations at the end of the footnote are not actually in conflict with the testimony by Mr. Pedersen that late fees are a problem. The tension there is between the fact that late fees are a problem and whose problem is it. So that's the conflict that they're talking about there. So just wanted to make that clear also. And then I'll move on to the termination fee issue. The judges did not address this in the brief, in their decision, and the reason is that, you know, there were hundreds and hundreds of arguments made below. Over 2,000 proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law were offered by the parties. And so the judges had to make decisions about which arguments they were going to address in their decision. And frankly, this termination right issue on the spectrum of merit ranks very low. And the reason is that if you look at the statutory language, I'll turn to 803C7, it is plain that Congress contemplated that the late fee and the termination right would coexist. And I have that here. It says, a determination of the copyright royalty judges may include terms with respect to late payment, but in no way shall such terms prevent the copyright holder from asserting other rights or remedies provided under this title. So I think that's responsive in itself to the point that Mr. Smith made. And so those are the primary points I wanted to make about the late fee. Are there any questions? Okay, well then I'll move on to the ringtone rate. We're happy to stand on the merits of our brief with respect to the reasonableness of the judge's decision, but I would just like to clarify for a moment our waiver argument because the reply brief mischaracterizes what we're saying in that respect. The record companies are certainly free to appeal just one aspect of the decision from below, putting aside, of course, the judicial estoppel and standing arguments made by the copyright owners, but just within the context of waiver. Our point is that when they bring that appeal here, they cannot rely on arguments that are contrary to the arguments that they made below. And so the problem with their argument here is that over and over again, they suggest that the judges acted arbitrarily and capriciously by failing to provide a separate analysis of the applicability of the revenue-based rate to ringtones. And the reason they waived that is because throughout the proceedings below, they argued in favor of a revenue-based rate and against a penny rate based on general arguments. They made general arguments throughout. At no point did they suggest that the revenue-based rate was particularly suited to ringtones, and at no point did they offer any arguments in favor of ringtones or in favor of
the
revenue.
Did they not make the argument about the market going down?
They made that argument for the entire Section 115 license. Now, at certain points, they argued that ringtones were unique with respect to the level of the rate. And of course, I think that was acknowledged by everyone in the proceedings below. But at no point did they argue that the rate structure that ringtones were unique in any sense with regard to the rate structure. So it's not surprising at all that when the judges wrote their decision, they also talked about the pros and cons of the revenue-based rate and the penny rate in general terms. So that's our point there. And maybe I'll just make one last point about Chenery. We are asking this court to affirm the judge's decision as it is written and the holdings of the judges. But of course, when we go on appeal, if a party makes assertions about the content of the record and bases their argument on those assertions, it's appropriate and necessary for the government to respond to those assertions, relying on the record as a whole. And that's what we've done here.
You all have the, you mentioned the ghost in the attic, the appointments clause is in the attic too?
Well, it's, no, I think it's currently in the district court proceedings, right, in Live 63, but, so we'll see how it is rolled itself there. If there are no further questions, we ask that you affirm the judge's decision.
Thank you. We'll hear from the intervener.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Jay Cohen for the interveners. If I can start where I think you focused most of your attention this morning. First, there's no dispute on this record that there are late payments, and there are late payments irrespective of the splits. The judges so found in footnote 50, where they cited the testimony of Mr. Pedicine, who testified about this billions of dollars of late payments, which have nothing to do with the splits. Because as Mr. Pedicine testified, and as the RIAA conceded in this context of voluntary licensing, and I'll come back to the statutory licensing in a minute, but the late fee evidence came from the voluntary market, there's no dispute that they're late. Now, Mr. Smith says they might be one day late, they may be 2 days late. We've exaggerated the essence of the problem. There was a problem. If they're one day late, they will pay 1/30th of 1.5%. They don't pay 18% for being one day late. It's a proportional late fee. So the judges acted well within their discretion on the undisputed evidence of late payments in saying there should be, in resolving all of the policy factors under 801B1, there needs to be a late fee to incentivize behavior. They did not say we're doing it just because we did it before. They're saying we're doing it as we did it before because we need to incentivize timely payment in this market. Now, let me turn to the statutory framework. It makes an enormous amount of sense to have a late fee in a statutory framework because our clients, the copyright owners, the owners of the musical works, who, by the way, Judge Radoff, don't get paid on every ring, just once, they have their property taken from them pursuant to a statutory license. And the statutory license, once the record is, musical work has been recorded and distributed, anyone else can go, as Mr. Smith said, and record another cover, another version of that musical work. You can't simply take the Beatles recording, but you can take the Beatles song and record it yourself, and you can get a compulsory license under 115. And there is an incredibly dense and detailed set of payment provisions that are completely inconsistent with the arguments that the RIAA is making. First of all, they acknowledged below that the splits don't impact the late fee. Ms. Finkelstein, who was the only record company witness on this subject, testified in her written direct testimony at page 404 of the joint appendix, I do not understand the late fee to apply before splits are worked out. Mr. Pedicine testified in the course of describing his study, as Mr. Smith called it, that the late fees that are charged and computed by Harry Fox, the late fee analysis that he did, started from the point when a license is taken. And a license is not taken in this voluntary marketplace until after the splits are worked out. Now, with respect to the statutory license, they have several options. If they don't know the identity of any of the owners of the copyright, that is addressed actually in the statute, not in the regs. 115B1 says, if you want to record a song, 115B1 of the Copyright Act, if you want to use a musical work that's already been distributed to the public and you don't know any of the owners of the copyright, so not just the split issue, you know nothing about the copyright owners, you can file with the Copyright Office. And 115C1 says that you're not required to pay until the copyright owners are identified. So in the context where nobody knows who the copyright owners are, no payment is in fact due until the splits are identified. The regs that we cited deal with the question of multiple ownership, and they make clear that what you can do under the statutory license is serve a notice of intention upon one of the co-owners and pay one of those co-owners.
Is this 201.18.A.6, or is this
another? Yes, this is the corrected citation, Your Honor. So it's, let me get it right. These are complicated regulations, and I apologize for the confusion.
Unlike the EOC regulations.
Very simple. This is much easier. 201.18.A.6 says, in the case where the work has more than one copyright owner, the service of the notice on any one of the co-owners of the non-dramatic musical work or upon an authorized agent of one of the co-owners shall be sufficient. And 201.19A.5, which is the corrected version of the payment, talks about how you pay in those circumstances. And the regs that the CRJ, that the judges cited, and the reason why in this complicated procedure there should be given substantial deference, have a very detailed procedure for how you pay by issuing statements of account and the like. And it's a very complicated procedure. But the late fee that they impose runs from due date under the statute and the regs. And what the register found in her ruling that's cited in the joint appendix with respect to the division of authority between the judges and the register, what the register found is the judges can deal with late fees. They can't deal with payment mechanism. And that's the context, Your Honors, for the judge's decision, which is you say there are problems. There is a statutory scheme for how to pay. And if you can, this is what they call the impossibility of compliance argument, which, by the way, they obviously did not accept, and they said that on page 660 of the record when they said that they were not accepting the impossibility of compliance argument that the RIA is making. But what they said is if you can't pay timely under the regs, that's a problem either for Congress or for the register. Our job is when it's due under those regs, when it's due, if it's not timely, should there be a late fee? And they exercise their discretion, and they're entitled to substantial deference that given all of the policy considerations that are bound up in 801B1 and given the undisputed evidence of late payments and given the evidence that the record companies themselves extract late payments in transactions that actually implicate the mechanical license, that it was appropriate to have a fee. And the RIAA never argued.
Mr. Cohen, yes, Your Honor. Sort of over. You don't want to give up your standing argument?
No, I don't want to give it. With respect, may I make that argument?
Yeah, I have to say I'm not quite sure I understand it.
So. Let me, I think, Your Honor, whether it's standing or estoppel or waiver, as the government argues, I think there was something, this is with respect to the penny rate.
Yes.
I think there's something fundamentally wrong with what the RIAA did. They were required under the regulations to submit a statement as to the rates and terms that they would deem acceptable. They said our preference is
4%. Let me read you what they said and see if I understand your argument. What they said is at JA 635. It says, RIAA believes that a percentage royalty rate structure is most appropriate, and RIAA does not advocate for a cents rate royalty for any category. However, in the event that the copyright royalty judges determine that a percentage royalty rate is not appropriate, RIAA has set forth below an alternative rate proposal.
Yes, Your Honor.
So they're saying this is what we think is right, right? Namely, the percentage. But if you rule against us, then please give us the following alternative. That's what they argued, right?
Absolutely.
And your argument is that that as a consequence of that, they can't now claim that the rejection of the percentage royalty rate was an error?
Let me back. Yes, Your Honor.
If that is your argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, now, what I want to ask you is distinguish this from the following hypothetical. You were here during the criminal case. The person is convicted of a drug conspiracy, goes to sentencing, and makes the following argument. A, I shouldn't have been convicted. You should overrule it, right? But if you don't, I want to go to jail for only 10 years, not the rest of my life. And the court says, okay, only 10 years. Is your position that he should not be able to appeal his conviction?
No, Your Honor.
Tell me how that's different.
Let me explain the difference. The context is important here, Your Honor. Obviously, arguments are made in the alternative all the time. Right. People go to trial in civil cases, and they say, I'm not liable, but here's my damages evidence. Right. So I understand that, Your Honor. The difference here is actually in the regs. What were they doing? And it's on page 631 of the joint appendix. They cite the reg under which their two-part proposal was submitted. It's 351.4B3, which is cited right at in the introductory language on page 631. And let me just read the one sentence from that provision in 351.4B3. In the case of a rate proceeding, each party must state its requested rate. They were free to below say to the judges, somebody else is arguing for a penny rate, and we think if it's going to be a penny rate, it should be different.
What about that regulation bars them from saying, this is our requested rate, but if you don't give it to us, give us this requested rate?
Because once you have requested a rate, what you're saying to the CRJs, and they relied upon it, is that is a structure I am prepared to live with.
What?
It's not my preferred alternative, but I'm proposing it.
If we took your argument, no one would be able to argue in the alternative.
I don't think, Your Honor, in this context, and the Southern Natural case that Mr. Smith cites talks about this at the beginning of the case, that it's good rate making to provide a menu of alternatives to they did not provide an alternative, for example, with respect to the late fee.
Has the agency ever, has this tribunal, the judges, ever said anything like what you're saying now?
No, Your Honor.
They never have.
No, Your Honor.
And no court's ever said anything like that.
I think if you look at the beginning of the Southern Natural case, which does go on to then discuss a couple of the two alternative scenarios.
You're relying on an interpretation of a regulation of this body, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And in any case, Your Honor, I'm happy to get past that issue on the penny rate because...
Maybe we shouldn't let you because your first position is...
That's it.
I think that's wrong, Your Honor.
The reason we can't let you is you're 6 minutes and 8 seconds over time.
Okay, Your Honor, but we will rest on our brief with respect to the exercise of the discretion of the judges with respect to the structure.
Thank you very much. We'll hear from Mr. Smith.
Just a couple of quick points, Your Honor. First of all, the primary reason we're concerned about the late fee is because, as written by the regulation, it is triggered by the sale of the record, not by the...
What do you say to their argument that the regulations say it's not owed until whatever they said? That is, it's not owed until you know who to pay.
The regulations don't say anything of the sort. The regulations
they say that you only have to pay when there's more than one owner, then you only have to make payment on one owner or the agent.
What the regulations say is you can pay one copyright owner and they'll distribute it. It has been a custom in the industries for the last 100 years not that you can't do that, and in fact the publishers will not accept that check when you try to send it to them. They insist that the payment not be made until the splits have been figured out in this voluntary system that has been negotiated. You have this system that has existed. The reason the Harry Fox Agency exists is because the particular payment system set up by statute is completely unworkable. It requires you to pay too quickly every month. And so they have this other system that's been set up, and it is undisputed that going back 80, 100 years, the publishers won't take that check for and distribute it on once the splits are figured out. The record company is supposed to wait and then pay the separate publishers. And so we're put in this position where we have a reg that says the late fee is triggered from the day you sell the record, and a system of payment that has evolved over the decades under which we can't make the payment the first time we sell the record. And that's the reason why we're here, frankly, this problem didn't arise until they decided they needed a late fee, which has never been one before in this industry.
This kind of issue you just mentioned, you couldn't appeal to the Register of Copyrights?
The issue of appealing to the Register of Copyrights, there isn't a formal appeal mechanism. You can ask them to refer an issue of law in the middle of the proceeding to the Register, and there have been a number of issues.
But this kind of question couldn't be.
I don't know that this question ever really crystallized until after we saw what they ruled, and they said that the late fee is going to be imposed and it's going to be triggered by the sale of the first record. So the issue just was not in fact referred. I suppose it's conceivable that if somebody had focused on it and done it in the right time in the right way, there might have been a way to do that. There is this referral for a legal opinion mechanism in the statute, as I'm sure you're quite aware, Your Honor. The other thing that I would want to just bring up, the reason why there probably isn't a need for a late fee, and this is precisely because we have the right to terminate on, as to these this license, where there wasn't a right to terminate in the other licenses that the judges relied on. So there is, in fact, an enforcement mechanism in this license that didn't exist elsewhere if you don't pay. And so that's a distinction which the judges gave great emphasis to when they were setting a late fee in the other two proceedings and then completely disregarded in this proceeding. The court has no further questions.
Thank you very much. Case will be taken under submission.
Of course.